Well, with that, I would like to introduce tonight's speaker. I've known this guy for almost 5 years now. I haven't heard his story yet myself, so I will be learning that with you as well. Without further ado, I give you Joe G. from Atmosphere of Recovery in North Pittsburgh.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Hi everybody, my name is Joe and I'm an addict.
Hi, Joe.
And it's an honor to be here. I want to thank the committee for choosing me. And I'll be quite frank about it, I was surprised when I got the call. But it's okay. I'm one of those people in NA that likes to speak. I've always been a storyteller. I like people. I like telling stories. And I also want to be helpful to people that were in my position when I got here. Because, and please, you can clap if you want to. It's up to you, but like, I'm not there yet. But on September 6th of 1984, I got clean. I've been clean since then, so I'm just pushing 31 years clean. But I'm not there yet, so... But, you know, this is really the message I want to give right now. I had 5.5 years clean, and I was going to hang myself. So if you have significant clean time, and when I came around in 1990, ready for business, 5.5 years after I got clean, now don't get me wrong, a day clean is a big deal for an addict, because we use drugs to the exclusion of our health and all kinds of other messed up stuff. And we will and have, many addicts have destroyed their lives and the lives of those that love them and those around them because of their drug use. So I do not mean to minimize in any way the importance of one day, because that's where it starts. But when I got here in 1990 ready to work this program, because I couldn't think of anything else to try except kill myself, I had 5.5 years clean. And that's significant clean time. And in 1990 in Pittsburgh, it was like very few people had that much clean time. So what I'm getting at is like, I had a lot of clean time and my life was more messed up and broken than it ever was when I was getting high. Let me qualify in the drug addict part, right? I think like an addict. When I was 3 years old, 3 to 5 years old, probably five, I stole money out of my mom's purse to go buy popsicles at the local store. And I remember walking up the alley with the dollar bill in my hand saying to myself, when I get older, I'll put a 50 back. You know, that's addict thinking, you know, and I know that now, right? And my life was characterized by that kind of thinking, justification, rationalization for my behaviors that I knew were wrong. I remember sneaking into her purse to get that dollar, hoping I wouldn't get caught, and hoping nobody find out that I went and bought these popsicles and stuff, because I knew that I was doing the wrong thing. But I made it okay in my mind by saying, someday when I'm older and I have a job, I'll replace it with $50. I'll make up for it. So that's just to characterize my thinking from way back I can remember. And when I found drugs, I was so happy. When I realized what they could do for me, because what drugs did for me, they made me okay in my own skin. They made all my anxieties go away. And I knew for a fact I was okay and was going to be okay as long as I was high. And my drug of choice was marijuana. So that's, and when I couldn't get that alcohol, mostly beer. And to get money for marijuana, I went into my, I got five sisters. My favorite sister when I was like about 17. Is Mary. And I knew where she kept her money. And I went into her underwear drawer in her room to get money to buy reefer. And I remember taking $50 out of her drawer, closing the thing. I looked at the money in my hand, and I said to myself, why are you doing this to her? She's never done anything to you. And the next thing I said is, fuck it, I need this. And I went and got the drugs I needed to feel okay. So, there it is. Any brush I ever had with the law involved drugs. And I'm lucky it was just a minor brush. Never got arrested, ever. And that's just my story. I wanted to say this one thing. If I offend anybody while I'm up here by anything I say, I mean this sincerely. You truly have my apologies, because that's not my intention. My intention is in to no way be harmful. But I am going to tell my story, as it is the only story I have to have to tell. And as my sponsor says a lot, he says, I don't know about you, but I know about me. So I'll know about you if you choose to tell me. But, you know, you might lie. But, you know, the bottom line is I know me. I lied to myself for a lot of years. But that's like I know when I'm lying to myself now. Or I figure it out pretty quickly, or I get help to figure it out. Because I want to know. I truly know that I'm capable of dying as a result of this disease clean. It almost happened to me, and I know it could happen again. And I know that I am absolutely 100% unequivocally positive that I'm capable of killing myself. I know that. And that just gives me the chills, but the reality is, as long as I know that and admit it and keep that out in front of me, that's my greatest insurance to have it not happen. But when I start lying to myself, it's a slippery slope. So anyway, that's me qualifying with the drugs and the addict thinking and everything. I got clean when I was 20. I'm 51 now. And when I was 19, I started to go to therapy, and I told the lady right up front, I said, look, I get high. She said, as long as you don't get high when you come here, we're good. And I kept that commitment. And we talked about my drugs a little bit, but mostly we talked about my damaged family relationship growing up, neglected, physically abused, not a whole lot of times, but just once or twice really stood out, and that just put the fear of God into me. It just like traumatized me, right? And like it just freaked me out, you know? I was always afraid anyway. My first memory in life was being in the crib, crying and afraid. Why? Can't tell you. Just was afraid. There it is. So anxiety dogged me my whole life. So what happened was, go to see this lady at 19, the drugs, you know, I just knew I was a mess. And I don't know about you, but I was always a seeker on the path of relief since the age of 19. And what I figured out is the way for me to get relief was going to have to be wellness. Because getting high, it was temporary. Getting drunk, it was fun, but it was temporary. And I did have, you know, brushes with my family, you know, like the, you know, coming in high. My parents would not tolerate that stuff. They would confront me. It was just sucked. One time my mom told me, you know, Joe, your brothers and sisters are really upset with you because they know you're stealing money from them. And I was felt ashamed and horrified. But I decided I better get this help. So I go to this therapist. And from the very first time there, I talked about the thing, something I never talked about before in my life. You know, about some of the specific abuse that happened in my family. And after a year, I'll never forget, I've been seeing her for about a year, and I felt so much better. I understood my, you know, critical parent and, the, you know, my thinking and how my family had caused me harm and blah, blah, blah. And all that's true. And she said to me, so Joe, are you ready to try life without drugs? And I was like, yeah, fuck them drugs. Because I was ready. Because I was like, I knew that was bullshit. I knew that that was, look, this is why I'm an addict. I use drugs to cope with life. They were my main coping mechanism. That's why I say I'm an addict. I don't care about anybody else's definition. I really don't. That's mine. That's for me. I lived it. I know I got high to cope with life. So I wanted to be better. I was like, yeah, so she suggested I go to meetings. I went to meetings. Long story short, in a short amount of time, I got clean, stayed that way. Now, because of the abuse in my life, I truly hated God. I heard a guy share from this very place a couple years ago. He said his relationship with God was, I didn't believe in him, but I hated him at the same time. You know, like I would say, there's no God, because if there was a God, what about all the horrible things that happened in the world, and God's all powerful and God's all loving, and you're going to tell me a loving power would let a child be harmed, blah, blah. And I used to say, if I was God, I wouldn't let that stuff happen. So hence, there wasn't one, or else he was a real sick, twisted, beyond sociopath, kind of maniacal, evil bastard. And so I blamed God for all the bad things that happened to me, but at the same time, I denounced that there was anything. What is God? I don't got a clue. Do I care what it is? I don't care. I just want help. I want help. So, I pray, I ask God for help. After, I don't know where it is. But anyway, so, life went on. At about 3 years clean, I started to get these obsessions that didn't make sense. I started to get obsessed about toxic waste, radiation, AIDS. And it just got worse. And at the end of 2 years and 3 months of these obsessions growing, and me not talking about it, and me hiding it because I was ashamed of what I was thinking. I was ashamed to tell people, I'm obsessed about getting AIDS off of a doorknob. And, like, it takes me half an hour sometimes to get out of the bathroom at Hillman Library, because if somebody's taking a leak, some guy, and he got herpes on his pecker, and then he touches his eye, he got herpes there, and now he's taking a leak. Everybody knows when a guy takes a leak, he's got a hold of sick. Okay? And this is like my thought process that no one was going to hear because it was shameful. Yeah. This is the first, to me, this is the first thing I ever shared with my first sponsor. I had my head down like this, and I was like, and if he gets the herpes virus on his hands and doesn't wash his hands or, you know, opens that door and I touch it, now I get it on my hand. And I work in a library. I'm going to go out and maybe touch a book. Now, some poor bastard will come behind, touch the book, touch her eye, go blind, and it's all my fault. And my first puncher goes, oh, my God, Hong Kong herpes. I busted out laughing. He helped me laugh about it. This is the first thing I ever shared with my sponsor. And I came into the program. My recovery day is March 9th of 1990. That was a Thursday. It was March 10th of 1990 that I shared that with him. He helped me laugh about it, and as truly bizarre as what I'm about to tell you is, when he told me this, I felt hope, and for the first time in my life, I talked to someone who was talking my language. They could go to me and say, I'm the same. What he said to me was about that whole Hong Kong herpes thing was, he said, you know, Joe, one day I noticed on my hand I had a wart, and I went, oh my God, I must have got this off some whore in Vietnam. Probably that weird looking one in Tam Quai. And he thought, and I'll give it to my girlfriend, and her whole body will turn into a giant wart. When he told me that, I literally felt a flutter in my chest and thought to myself, oh my God, this guy's speaking my language. See, that never happened to me because I hid. First off, I wouldn't talk about what's going on with me. Now, as crazy as that is and the toxic waste and all the rest of it, stuff that's even more bizarre and more weird obsessions than that, I was going to hang myself in my bedroom to make them stop. So, all the humor aside, and I truly see the humor in that kind of really weird shit going through my mind. It's funny now. I laugh about it. I can talk about it. I was going to kill myself to get free out of that. I was so desperate and hopeless and broken and traumatized in my mind by my obsessions, ravaged. I was raped by my mind for years and didn't tell anybody. Because if you knew, I knew you wouldn't like me and I wouldn't have any friends. I had to be so broken and so desperate that I would do anything to make it stop. Now, if you're at that point with your drug usage or whatever's going on with your life, you got a real good chance of this working for you. Because you'll do what's suggested, like I did, and you'll just be like, I can't take the pain, I can't take the trauma, I can't take the horror, I want it to stop. Something inside me cried out anything but this. You got it shot. Because I've seen it in my 25 plus years of working a program and sponsoring people. People that are like, yeah, but they might make it, they might not. But usually people, my experiences, I did not see the light. I felt the heat. In 1984, I had about 6 months clean. I'm at a meeting. They're talking about God. I hated God. The only thing I did is got a home group. That's it. I went there, helped set up. Like I said, I like people. I like socializing. It was cool. I went. I liked it. But around 6 months, I sat around this table hearing these people talk about their problems. And I was like, man, I've been in therapy for a year now. Over a year. And like, these people are fucked up. These people need this. God bless them. But I don't need it. And I just went out the door. This is why I stayed clean, by the way. I knew then, as I know now, I cannot have a good life and use drugs. That's why I stayed clean, if you're wondering. Also, I just happened to quit when I could say I quit. See, the disease of addiction is progressive. And the reality is that I believe that most of the people sitting here could have quit using on their own like I did if they quit in time. But most of us, we don't have a sufficient motivation to quit in time. And by the time we get motivated enough, it's not our decision anymore. It's not a matter of, wow, this is really messing my life up. I don't like what's happening. I quit. Now, during the course of my using, I quit a lot of times. I used to throw reefer in the Pine Creek and watch it float away. I gave it to my friends, and the next day I'd be like, damn, why'd I do that? But at that moment, when I was getting rid of it, I was so sincere about quitting forever, like, that I threw the shit away. Like, I mean, that's the action of true sincerity. Actions speak louder words. Like, I'm done. Throw it in the creek, good riddance. You know, I buried a joint and a half one time when I was high, going, I'm done forever. And I went back the next day, dug up, and I only found half of the one. I was like, fuck! And now it was reefer, okay? So, whatever. You know, drug's a drug, and that's enough for me. So on to the, try to get some continuity here and make sure I don't go over to try to, okay. I started to get these obsessions, didn't tell anybody. See, I had a set of core beliefs that I figured out all by myself. After I got in a program, it actually says in the NA basic text, everything that we know, especially what we know to be the truth, must be subject to revision. It doesn't mean we'll change it, but it means we need to put it under the light of scrutiny and consider, is this really true? We got to subject it to revision. There's things I haven't revised since I got here. I still don't believe certain things that I believed since I was a young child. But there are certain things I believed, and they almost got me to hang myself. So I'm going to tell you what they were. And if you relate to this, you know, you're like me. which isn't necessarily a bad thing, because I got a solution to the shit of a life I had, the hell I lived, the torment. Like, my first sponsor, remember I said that first conversation? He talked about being in Western Psych so zapped up on Thorazine, right? That he would shuffle along like this. And he said, the only problem, Joe, with the drugs in Western Psych were they didn't stop the clawing tear inside of me. I could still feel the clawing tear. And that's another thing that I related to. Like, fuck. And this dude was so zapped on Thor's, he said, I could still feel it in me. I related to that. And so during that first conversation, I'll get back to the other thing, but he said to me, we're sitting on these steps. By the way, when I shared the herpes thing, I'm sitting on one step below him with my head down between, looking down between my knees, because I was so ashamed that I could think something like that and be so messed up and desperate behind something that goddamn crazy. Look at, I was crazy, but I wasn't fucking stupid. I knew this shit was whack, but I couldn't make it stop. And it says in this book, I brought it here, it's the It Works How and Why, page 14. It says, the disease of addiction can manifest itself in obsessions and compulsions that we never had a problem with while we were using. Well, I had 3.5 years before it jumped off on me. And it was a horror show after that. So anyway, we're sitting there talking, and I'm thinking to myself, this guy's talking about Vietnam. He's talking about, you know, coming home and finding his wife dead of suicide. He said, I come home from the bar. He was a musician. I was having a great time. I'm bebopping to the house, the apartment, whatever. Go in the bedroom, and there's my wife. She'd committed suicide. And her suicide note was this beautiful love poem addressed to me. And I was like, damn. Like, wow, that's heavier than any of the shit I went through as a kid. And then he said, and I went to Western Psych like it was a revolving door, like it was a resort. I was in that, and I'm thinking, like, I gotta have a fucking chance. Because this guy, if this guy could get better, I gotta at least have a chance. Because this dude, wow. And then he said to me, I'm sitting on a step here. He's on the step above, and he says, but you know, after we start to get a period of freedom in our lives, I literally slid closer to him because I had to have it. I said, what do you do? And he said, if you want what I have, do what I do. See, I don't really, I never really experienced what I'm about to say in my life other than to hear the saying. I've never really lived with a person who said, don't do as I do, do as I say. But I hate that. When I hear that, I think hypocritical bullshit. That's what I think. And I'm glad I never had to be around a person that lived that way. But I don't respond to that at all. And if someone comes up to me with like, well, I never tried it, but, or whatever. Look, you may be very well-meaning, but fuck off. But anyway, he said, if you want what I have, do what I do. And I said, what do you do? He said, freedom. See, I really, there are no words. There are no matter how outrageous I would become in my speech or the volume or animated waving and yelling, and I've done it from the podium, I cannot impress upon you the depth of torment and desperation I was in. The hopelessness. I can't. I literally cannot do it. I've cried at the podium, like, just remembering how bad it was, like wept, and I got to get myself together to continue. But if you've been there, you know. If you haven't been there, I'm glad. Stop now. But if you are like me, and you're really an addict, and you haven't been there, and you keep using, I got really bad news. If you don't die along the road, or lose your mind permanently, and permanently, you will know, and hopefully you'll remember back and say, I remember that guy at the retreat, he was talking about an inability to express the feeling of desperation, terror, and hopelessness in words, or in expressions, or in volume of voice. You'll know there's hope, because a guy like me got better. I came to my first spiritual retreat in May, 1990. The guy that drove me up here is sitting here, and I saw him right away, so I thought of the story. And on the way up, I'm driving up with him, and I still remember some stuff he said. First thing I do is I get in his van. There's no seatbelt in the passenger side. We're driving his van. I said, I'm going to sit in the back where there's a seatbelt. He said, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And so he says, you know, and he mentioned his brother was killed in a car crash. I'm like, holy fuck, now I offended him. You know, I won't sit in the front seat. There's no seatbelt. And then he just shared with me his story about, like, how, you know, he lived in the country and loved nature and mountain brooks, and he's sitting there in his life and in his using, and he notices along the river there's these little eddies where the water gets kind of slow and stagnant and full of like algae and just debris, and it hit him like, that's what my life's become. I'm out of the stream of life. I'm like this, you know. And he shared some stuff with me, but he let me smoke all the cigarettes I wanted, his cigarettes. And mostly he let me just talk. And I'm talking about like my girlfriend from college, and I don't know if I can live without her, and toxic waste and radiation and AIDS off of doorknobs, and I know it's crazy, but I can't make it stop, and you know, I'm fucking hyper suicidal for years, and now I'm in recovery and I'm on fire. You know, and that's really what I was like. And he's like, and he was really kind to me, and he drove me up. Years later, he says, hey, Joe, I want to tell you something. I'm like, what's that? He says, you know, as we were driving up to that retreat, it was like 5 years into my recovery or 3 years, some years later, he said, I thought to myself, this guy's fucked. He said, I thought to myself, this guy's never, ever gonna make it, because he's too far gone. That's why he really thought I was doomed. It's because I was too far gone mentally. I didn't have a drug problem when I got here, 5.5 years clean. But I was so wrecked by the disease and the obsessions and the fear and the isolation. I can't tell anybody because they won't like me. Deal with it. I dealt with it. I was ready to get high. I was starting to contemplate, who can I find so I can get some reefer off of? Because I was never had very good connections, and I was out of the game so long. But I was ready to get high. Because see, I knew that it wouldn't work and make my life better, but I knew it might buy me 6 months. And maybe something would happen. And I wouldn't have to kill myself. That was the thought behind it. But luckily, I didn't find anybody. And he said, Joe, you give me hope because, like, look at you now. It's like however many years later and you're alive. But not only that, I see you. I watch people here from the beginning till now. You know, and he said, and like, your recovery has really blown me away. In the sense, not because it's so great, I'm sure, or like I'm so spiritual or did everything right, just because I'm not as crazy and I'm not dead. I think that's what blew him away. I had a nickname in NA early on, Crazy Joe. It was a nickname nobody told me to my face. I didn't even know I had it. Until a very good friend of mine in the program, a different person, said, you know how we use nicknames in here? I'm like, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, like Motorcycle Joe. I knew who he meant, the guy that always rode his motorcycle. And so, because we don't use last names here. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know what you mean. He says, well, you know, you got a nickname. I was like, Really? I was all happy, like I got nicknames. Because to me, like, nicknames are like cool. It's like street. It's like, you know, something you get. It's like credibility. You know, like this guy's like, this is Viper. They're like, damn, he must be a scary motherfucker. You know? Or this guy, he's like Hot Fingers. You know, it's like, oh, that sounds cool. So I'm ready for my nickname, and he goes, Crazy Joe. And I'm like, yeah, cool, man. Because when you're in the street and you're crazy, you're safe because, like, people don't know what you'll do. And then my next thought was, like, I don't want to be Crazy Joe. Look, I know what I'm about to tell you is true. I should be dead. I never should have met any of you. Ever. Because I should be dead. Based on my projection, what was going to happen, how it was going to go down. I actually had an experience that I learned about when I worked at St. Francis Hospital. I got interviewed to work in the psych hospital. I had about 3 years in recovery, and I could actually hold a job now. My first 2 years in recovery, I lived at my parents' house, couldn't hold a job, and I was 26 years old and a college graduate. And I didn't move out till I was like 28. Because I couldn't do it. I couldn't. I was so broke. And she said, you know, Joe, if you do get a job here, it's Peggy Sieber, the head nurse of all of the psychiatry department, and you're on the depression floor, you need to watch out for depressed people that become very happy all of a sudden. And I'm like, why is that? She says, because they've made the decision to kill themselves. And they're at peace with it. And that's why that's a red light. They're ready to hang themselves in their bedroom. They're ready to kill themselves. I know for a fact, I know why people say he contemplated suicide. Because based on my experience, it is not something that's entered into lightly. I contemplated this shit from the age of 15 when I tried to kill myself before I found drugs to take the shit away from me that I couldn't stand inside, my fear, anxiety, and that. I tried to kill myself to make it stop. Make it stop. The shit I couldn't make not happen inside of my mind that made me hate my life. So, if you relate to me, all I can tell you is, like, you got a shot. Like, you do. You got a real shot. Like, you can be okay. That's the good news. The bad news is, you're going to have to work your fucking ass off. If you're like me. And you know what? Look, if you guys come here and go to meetings and work the steps and you get better, that's nice. That's excellent. But I'm really not that concerned about that. I'm concerned that I fucking make it. That I get to the end of my life and die clean without self-inflicted wounds. Like a gun in the mouth or a rope around my neck. Or you know what? Fuck it. I'll do 100 miles an hour and just wreck into that bridge abutment. Fuck it. Because see, that's where I came from. What year's clean. But I had this experience that Peggy Sieber talked about, the nurse at St. Francis, because during the course of what I call the dark years, it was like 2 years and 3 months where I really started getting sick with these obsessions to the end when I got to the program and did what I needed to get better. Like, tell people what's going on with me. I remember I had this conversation down at the University of Pittsburgh between Forbes Quadrangle and Hillman Library, and they got these places you could sit. And I remember saying out loud, and I was not psychotic, I knew exactly what I was saying, I knew exactly what I was doing, and I had a conversation with my older brother like I would have had if he was there. And I said, you know, Pat, I'm really sorry about this. I'm sorry about mom and dad and all you guys. Hey, brothers and sisters.
And I'm sorry that you're going to feel all this pain because I killed myself. And you got to deal with it. But I can't deal with this. That's why you have to do it. And after that, I was so happy. Because I finally came to that place that Peggy Siebert talked about. I was at peace with doing it.
And it took me many years to get to that point. What got me there? First off, I was talking about my book, you know. I figured these things out all by myself, what I'm about to tell you. Remember, subject to revision? Everything we know, especially what we know to be the truth, must be subject to revision. First one was, don't get emotionally close to people. Don't let people matter to you. Because if you let people matter, that's an open invitation to pain. Emotional pain. They could die on you, they could leave you, they could like break your heart. And if you get close to people, you're just, it's stupid, because you're going to fucking suffer, eventually. So I live by that principle, right? The second one I figured out was, don't trust people. Don't trust people, because when you trust people, you let your guard down, and you're vulnerable. And when you're vulnerable, people can hurt you. And the last one I figured out was, if someone does something to you that really harms you, hold a grudge. And hate that bastard so much in your mind that they suffer. Remember the old saying, resentment's like drinking poison and expecting the guy you're mad at to die. You know, like, and that's what I live by. I live by that. And you know what I find out? First off, I like people. I don't know about you, but people are what make life interesting, vital, and worthwhile, and super duper to me. Like, I've been to, in my recovery, I've been to Sweden four times, been to Ireland as many times, more even, and traveled overseas. And every time I went to Sweden, every time I went to Ireland, it was to see people that I know there, that are friends or family. I'll tell you the truth. I really, yeah, they're pretty places. And when I was there, I was like, wow, it's pretty and everything. But that's not why I went. It was because of the relationships. My nature is to care about people. My nature is to care about people. My nature is I like people. I want people to be happy. I want everyone to be happy, joyous, and free. That's my nature. But I cut myself off from that nature because of fear. And then the other one, fear, it was just... My first 3 days in recovery, I went from meeting to meeting, riding the bus because I didn't have a car or nothing. And I kept saying to myself, could I have been wrong? Could I have been wrong? Because my core belief system was the total opposite of healthiness. And yeah, I could have been wrong, and A, I was wrong, and that's a big part of what got me to the precipice of killing myself. Clean. And I could still do it. All I got to do is do what I did before I got here. Mm-hmm. Isolate. Don't really tell people the truth. I was real big on, and still am on, the unedited version of what's going on with me. Because my experience is, the more it bothers me, and the more it's really making me want to like just get away from it, and escape it, and run from it, usually that's the thing I need to share the most. Fuck! That's hard. I mean, it's hard to like just tell the truth about this thing that's making me so ashamed and feel so fucked up about myself and so sure you won't like me. It's like, okay, Joe, what are you going to do? That's what I said to myself when I was new. What are you going to do? You're going to do this? Or are you going to do this? And I'll tell you why I tried this program. I'd been around, you know. And I even took another run at the fellowship in at about 3 years clean because I was getting on nuts. But all I heard them talk about was using. I thought, oh man, I've been clean longer than most of these people here. And they're talking about just using. It's like, there's nothing here for me. And, oh man, so bad. So bad. For my first 8 years in recovery, just the relief from the obsessions and the fear and everything, I had instant gratitude for the first 8 years, like, without even thinking about it. I go, oh wow, you should be dead. Fucking A, I'm alive and shit. You know, like, dude, oh my God, you got a flat tire. Oh man, this beats the hell out of being in a grave decomposing. Woohoo, let me fix that flat tire. You know? And I could still get there real easy if I just remember. Oh, by the way, just real quick, what it was like. It's real important for me to go into that for me. But most of this is really why I do it mostly, I think. I want some poor, hopeless, desperate, lost soul like I was to get hope because of my story. For them to go, that guy's just like me. I relate to that. Like, I never heard anybody talk like this before. I thought I was done. I thought it was over. I thought there was no way out of this. It was just like done. But because they hear what I say, they're like, there's hope. There's hope. Like, I really can't believe it. It's blowing my mind. See, because I just knew I was done. There was this thing inside of me. I could feel it. It was deeper than my mind's eye. You know, you see things in your mind's eye, you know. Like, oh, I remember being at my friend's yesterday. And you think about it, you see, you know. But this was deeper. And I could see this light inside of me going out. It was wavering. I only ever heard one person in 25 years share about this in a way that, like, related to. This lady talked about feel real cold inside. And she knew she was close to death. And I knew what she was talking about because I had this light. It wasn't a coldness, but I could see the light flickering. And that's where I was. See, I used to say to myself, guys like you don't get better. Boo fucking who, too bad. That's what I said to me, privately. At the end, the last couple months or whatever. Like, you're just fucked, dude. You're fucked. And I knew I was. You know why I did this? Called my brother Pat up, who had 3 years in recovery, working a program. He's still clean. He's got 20-whatever years clean and in recovery. And I called him up. I told him what was going on. He said, Joe, you sound like an obsessive-compulsive addict that needs a meeting. And I said to him, dude, I got more time clean than you. What are you talking about? He said, it ain't just about using, dude. It's a disease. And he said, Joe, do what I did. I told myself, I'll go to, and Pat, it's just weird, the guy that I had that conversation with, that fictional conversation about, like, I'm sorry to the family and everything, he's the guy I call. We're really not that, you know, we're close, but, you know, I got 8 brothers and sisters. I got favorites. He's not one of them. But I love them and all that. Yeah, but whatever. I'm much closer and spent more time and shared different experiences with other members. He's the oldest, so we're kind of not too close in age, and that kind of does put up barriers in some ways. And he moved away when he was 19, and I was, like, still a kid. But anyway, he said, I told myself, I'll do everything they say for 90 days. Everything. And then when it doesn't work, I'll kill myself. And when he told me that, I was like, fuck, I gotta do this. Because, you see, I don't know about you, but my number one thing that kept me alive for years was fear of hell. And I figured it out. If I could die with a clean conscience, God will cut me a break. But that means I got to try everything I can even conceive of. And I did that, and he threw one more thing at me. And I said, 91st day, punching my ticket. Well, it was less than 90 days when I rode up to that first spiritual retreat. And I was getting better, and I kept doing this. But in the meantime, what happened? I've had the opportunity to get married twice. I'm currently married to my second wife. I remember riding on the bus down through Northside, going by Carlisle's wedding shop, looking at all those beautiful bridal dresses, and almost starting to cry on the bus because I knew I'd never have a bride because I was going to be dead. That was during the dark years. Well, I got to have a bride. I got to have two of them. So that's a dream come true. I got to live that. I got to go back to school, get my teaching certificate, and I was a teacher in the city schools of Pittsburgh, inner city, for 13 years, and I got a pension. I had a career. Joe and career did not go in the same sentence at the end. Joe and maybe I could hold a job like, you know, I don't know, something real easy. I've worked in 12 steps. With a sponsor. I've had a couple different sponsors during the course of my recovery. My current sponsor I've had for about, it could be anywhere from 16 to 18 years. I've gone through lulls in recovery where I drifted away, felt myself getting crazy, got back on board, and I was doing better. In the course of my recovery, I've learned that I also have, here it comes, guys, a mental illness. I have obsessive compulsive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, and depression. And it was brought to my attention. I might need to take medication. I was like, medication? I'm fucking clean, man. So for 3 years of my recovery, I gutted it out. I chased this program like a rabid animal. And I exhausted myself, and I finally capitulated to medication because I couldn't keep that pace up anymore, and I started cracking up again. I lost my job with the district because in 2010, I had to go to psychiatric hospitalization for the first time in my life, 2 weeks in Western Psych, because my meds quit working. And it was horrible, and I went back to, I took a year and a half off of work. I went back for 1 year. I couldn't hack it anymore. I got disability retirement from the district. That's a gift. See, I didn't get high over any of that shit. In fact, I'm in Western Psych. They're like, we'd like to give you this. It's an antihistamine that'll help anxiety. I said, I'm fucking taking that shit. After about like a week in there, I finally, or 5 days, I said, I'll take it. And I went up to the counter and I said, I'm not drug seeking, but I'll take it. And they said, that's cool. And I sat and talked to my psychiatrist every day almost at Western Psych to see you once a day when you're, like, admitted, and cry. Because I was so desperate and hopeless again. And I didn't think this could happen again to me. Because I thought I was bulletproof. I had the program. I had God and blah, blah, blah. Why have all that? But this program is really, really good for dealing with addiction. It's issues. And a lot of what, you know, this shit going on in my mind was addiction too. They're related. Like OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Well, the two main aspects of this disease are obsessions and compulsions. So what came first? I don't know. But I have a really good life now. Really good. And I'm happy a lot of the time. But you know what's most important? My life's bearable. It's like good. Like, I just wanted some relief from, I'm a lot better than I was. So I have my days, but seriously. So anyway, it's time. I just want to tell you, if you're an addict, or you can relate to this kookiness that I shared about, you can get better. But not if you do what you want to do. Work the program, do what other people tell you to do. And yeah, my best thinking got me behind this podium. My name's Joe and I'm an addict.